Hello, I'm Dr. John Bullock, sitting in for Mark Steiner, and you're listening to WEAA-FM, celebrating the 88 Days of Summer. Details at WEAA.org. Call us at 410-319-8888. You can email your thoughts to talk@steinershow.org or tweet at Mark Steiner. Also, you can comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page. In the studio, we have Dr. Margaret Flowers, organizer with popularresistance.org and co-host of the Clearing the Fog radio program. We also have by phone Carla Murphy, reporter and blogger for colorlines.com. And also by phone, we have Edward Wyckoff Williams, contributing editor at The Root, political commentator and special correspondent with Al Jazeera America, and columnist and political analyst who appears on MSNBC, ABC, and CBS, and nationally syndicated radio. Thank you all of our guests for being here this morning.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for having us.
You know, this is a topic that unfortunately is becoming too common, which is the killing of unarmed African Americans. Particularly, we were talking today about Michael Brown and Renisha McBride. But again, it's all too common given the cases of Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis and Jonathan Farrell, Eric Garner, John Crawford, just to name a few. And so I did want to start with Carla. I know you've written a piece that talked about the perceptions of African American men and how they aren't looked at as victims. Could you go a little into depth about that?
Yeah, sure. So the piece focused on young African American men. I used Chicago as a case study, but it looked at young African American men as victims of violent crime, and it asked what happened to them after. The piece is on colorlines.com, but to get to the point about perceptions of young African American men, the main thing that my reporting found was that how these men are perceived determines whether people are compassionate, respond compassionately to them, or whether they can access aid after they've become a victim of violent crime. And one of the young men I spoke to, I mean, they're very clear about it. They see us all as gangbangers, and how they're treated proceeds from that initial perception.
Edward, you would like to chime in on this one? I know you've also written a couple pieces, and one just talking about how black boys are not safe on our streets.
Yes. I think a part of the problem is that black boys are presumed to be guilty in a society that says that the basis of its criminal justice system is the presumption of innocence. And we're watching a very tragic cycle where a child is dead, and whether it's a police officer or a wannabe police officer like George Zimmerman, the child dead now has to defend their own innocence in court, and it's really odd the way that I've watched the Michael Brown case play out. Even with the protests, the peace, what started off as peaceful protests, the police brought attack dogs to the protest, which just gave me images of the Jim Crow South and how African Americans are always seen as violent. Even when they are protesting for peace, there's something sick and twisted and rotten at the heart of the American, or lack thereof, the American dream when it comes to African Americans. There's a real problem here, and I don't even think that the election of the first African American president has been able to correct this. I'm getting to the point now where I'm demoralized by these stories, and I'm demoralized by having to cover them.
You know, I mean, you mentioned, you know, harkening back to the Jim Crow South, and I think a lot of us have that feeling, and also just being, you know, really fed up, honestly, by some of this this activity and these murders. Dr. Flowers, I know that you've done some work on these issues, and you wanted to talk about some of the root causes of this, and one of those was that over-militarization of the police.
Absolutely. Thank you. On popularresistance.org, I've been kind of pushing this for a number of months now. Just fortunately, there are reports coming out that are starting to attempt to document government, the over-militarization of our police forces, the fact that the Department of Defense is offering free weapons, tanks, assault rifles, all kinds of things. And our own National Guard is training police forces in these military techniques. And so it all becomes this kind of war culture where instead of being concerned with public safety and common sense approaches to what's going on, we see this kind of over-militarization and the mentality that the streets are a war zone. We even have quotes from sheriffs calling the streets a war zone. And so this is kind of the wrong response to kind of the trends that we're seeing in our country of, you know, poverty and our prohibition practices that are kind of, instead of responding to those appropriately with public policy to ameliorate those, we're seeing this kind of over-militarization and excessive response.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else will chime in? I think that this, really opens up a real investigation of what's really happening here. I had mentioned some names as we started off, and I think it's interesting to give some context to how these people were killed. So on one hand, you have the over-militarization, with the drug war and everyone is an enemy, everything is an obstacle. But also think about the people who were really, killed either by police or even by regular citizens, right? So whether it was over loud music in the case of Jordan Davis, you had Jonathan Ferrell, who was actually running toward the police after having a car accident and was actually failed. Killed. You have Eric Garner in New York, killed with a chokehold. You also have recently back in down Ohio, John Crawford, who was holding a BB gun in near the toy section, who was also shot down. So I really want to get some feeling as to why this is happening, not just with men, but also with women, with Renisha McBride, who again, the person who was now convicted of second degree murder and manslaughter, claimed that he felt he was in danger. And he grabbed the shotgun and he shot through the door.
Well, I think as you just effectively showed, the names are kind of washing over you. I was actually having a conversation yesterday where we were saying it's kind of hard to keep track, mm-hmm. right? And then the question becomes, now, are these shootings of unarmed men and women, are they happening more? Or is it that they're being captured more? So captured by recordings, for example. And I'm not sure. I don't know what the answer is to that yet.
If I could respond, I mean, I think the citizens' media is really critical, and it's done a lot to kind of bring these issues to light. But I wanted to quickly touch on the point that you raised, Carla, about perception, because there's also – we see attempts by the police to justify their actions after the killing by smearing the reputations of the people that are killed.
Yes.
So if we look at Alan Bluefield in Oakland, California, who was killed, shortly before he was to graduate from high school, he was waiting on a corner for his friends to pick him up, and unmarked police officer, car comes up, and he thinks it's a gang and runs away and is shot and killed in the back. So he's then smeared as they say that he had a gun or he was on drugs. None of those turned out to be true. Same thing with young Kamani Gray in New York, 16 years old, just adjusting his belt line, and the police come after him and kill him and then try to make him look like some sort of a criminal. These are the things that we have to bear in mind so that when we hear these stories, we don't take them at face value and understand that this behavior is going on by the police.
I'm really glad that you said that, because I think that that's really key. The criminalization of black males, I think, is something that we've discussed, ad nauseum at this point. But I don't think that the wider public truly understands how deeply entrenched that is in the way that police go about prosecuting cases and the way that they try to explain away their own criminality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And with the St. Louis case, it almost is, it's so blatant because they themselves came out with different versions of the story trying to basically justify the actions of the police officer, and it happened so quickly and there was so much light on it, and thank God for that, because otherwise it would be a Kamani Gray story. I'm really glad that you mentioned that. I was on television on MSNBC talking about that when it first happened, but it quickly became something that people forgot, and I think that that's a part of the problem, is that there are almost so many of these stories, and we live in an ADHD society now, where people literally just move on to the next story. They move on to the next murder. They move on to the next thing that Kim Kardashian is doing. Like, there's no serious investigation. There's sort of a blanket investigation of these things. But this is becoming systemic, and it's deeply ingrained in the way that our criminal justice system works, and I think that we have to stay on it, essentially.
You know, if you're listening right now, what do you think about these two cases and the police reaction to them? Please call us and comment at 410-319-8888. We actually should go to the phones right now. Let's see. We have Bruce on the line.
Yeah, so I'm listening to this. This is just complete rhetoric. Do me a favor. I'll try to keep my cool, but respect what I have to say. First off, to compare Trayvon or George Zimmerman with this case is apples and oranges. That's wrong. And then right away, you make some incendiary statement about Jim Crow South. That's not what this is about. Next thing, the police don't prosecute the cases. The state's attorney does. You know, this is absolutely ridiculous. So maybe this nut that's on – well, I shouldn't have said that. Let me rephrase. Maybe this person that keeps talking about the police, the militarization of police, maybe you should be a police officer. Police officers make mistakes, black and white. So were they overzealous? I don't know. But this incendiary stuff, the militarization of the police is ridiculous. Personally, I wish the police would come in my neighborhood more often, and I support them. And the next thing is the criminalization of the black community. That's nonsense. That's absolutely ridiculous. I would also suggest you read every week the city paper, and you look at the homicides. And what does it say? African-American, African-American, African-American. And you know who's killing them? Other African-Americans in the black community. This is absolute racist dogma. This is incendiary language. You're just making things a lot worse between the races.
John, can we cut her off?
Thank you, Bruce. Well, what this does, though, it opens up an interesting conversation, right? Because we could talk about, crime and police, but what we do see is a litany of names of African Americans who, might I add, are unarmed, who are either killed by police or who are killed by private citizens. And so there is, in fact, a criminalization of African Americans. On top of that, one thing that we can add, and I would challenge anyone to look this up, let's go and try to find cases of unarmed white civilians being shot down by the police or other citizens.
I'm really glad you said that. I'd really like to see those statistics, because it's something that I thought about in light of the Michael Brown case. That is it that we don't cover stories when white people are killed under suspicious circumstances by police officers, or is it that those cases simply just don't exist? Because there's a litany of African Americans, particularly young African American boys, being killed by police officers or wannabe police officers, but yet I don't see that happening to white children in America.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that these policies, these criminal justice policies, are racist. I mean, if you just look at the statistics of, you know, if it's a white person shooting a black person, it's much less likely that white person is going to be held accountable. If you look at the mass incarceration, the stop and frisk policies, you see that they are primarily affecting people of color. We have a young organizer that works with us at Popular Resistance who's white, lives in Baltimore, went to a public high school in Baltimore, and he says he's always been able to do things that his own friends who are people of color were not able to do. So even he recognizes that white privilege.
So I just want to draw a distinction here that the caller actually brought up for me, which is that we are lumping together these shootings because the victims in them are typically young African-American men or women. But there is a distinction to be drawn, an important one, between suspicious shootings done by police and those done by private citizens.
Yeah. Right.
One of them is sanctioned by the state to use deadly force.
Mm-hmm.
That requires a different response. Now, you know, I just want to emphasize that enough.
I think that's an appropriate distinction. I also see Alan on the phone. Is Alan still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for calling in.
First of all, I think that woman was, she didn't take her meds, in my opinion, and it's not destroying, if I come to a doctor and the doctor says, you've got stomach cancer, I'm going to give you a couple of aspirin and send you home, that's not medicine. We have a sick and dying society, and if we say that there's the militarization of the police, in fact, it is militarization when they patrol the Africans. African communities like an occupying army, and they feel that they can stop and frisk young black men at will. That, in fact, is an occupying army, and black communities are in fact occupied territories, much like the Gaza is occupied territories by the Zionist police, and we have to take that into consideration. And yes, when political activists like in protests like in Canada, there was an unarmed young white man that was shot down by the police. So yes, that does happen, but it does not happen as rarely as the as it does, as frequently as it does for young black men who whose only existence is being young and black and being quote unquote in the wrong place at the wrong time. And October 22nd is supposed to be a month of mass resistance against the mass arrests and criminalizations of African American youth. I would suggest people go to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, which was started by Carl Dix from Baltimore and Cornell West, and a number of other revolutionary minded individuals that take part in these activities that will be happening across the country.
Yeah, no, I thank you so much for providing that information. But let's continue on this conversation. I think, you know, we see a litany of names. I think it's important to recognize that, you know, there are movements around these things. And I think it was also interesting seeing the protests. Some of them were peaceful. Some of them wound up to be less peaceful. We should probably give a little context to some of the tweets that are going. I think, Dr. Flowers, you mentioned some of the tweets that are coming from live tweets that are coming.
Yeah, I've been following the tweets from Ferguson, Missouri, after the killing of Michael Brown. And it's really interesting. You know, the community came out to mourn his death, support his parents and his grandmother. And we saw immediately, you know, more than 50 police vehicles called to the scene. We saw them bring in the tanks. And then when people, you know, were marching, bringing in tear gas last night, pointing assault rifles at people, just this really over-the-top response to a community that has been suffering, you know, pretty serious levels of poverty. And then you have something like this that just, you know, brings some tensions up. And rather than treating it in a way that would make sense, that would be restorative and healing to the community by allowing them to have this outpouring of mourning and then supporting them in that, we see instead this very antagonistic, aggressive approach, which just seems very inappropriate.
One of the things that I read that I thought was quite profound, and I can't quite remember who the quote was by, but it said that riots are the language of the unheard.
Mm-hmm. That word just read my mind. That's Dr. King's quote. And people don't associate that with Dr. King. They think about peace and love, but that's Dr. King. Yes,
okay.
It is.
It was a part of an article about Michael Brown. So I couldn't remember the author of the article or who the author of the quote was. But I'm glad that it's Dr. King, because maybe it'll have more resonance with people, right? Because it certainly resonated with me. I'm not out in Missouri. I'm not covering it on the ground, so I don't know if there were any bad actors in the crowds, right? But the truth of the matter is that when we march for a reason, you know? When we hold signs up for a reason. And when we try to mourn the dead who have been killed for no reason except that they were walking down the street being black, we deserve to be heard. And so this over-militarization, despite the fact that one of the callers thought that that was a fraud, that's real. And the reactions to our pain are so sort of callous that the only response sometimes is another act of violence. That's really problematic. I can't necessarily promote that, but it almost gets to a point where that's the only option.
Yeah, thank you so much. We're going to run to a break, but on our way to break, you're going to be hearing Have You Heard by the Pat Metheny Group. Pat Metheny was born on this day in 1954. We'll be back.
It's coming on, 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 it's coming on. Finally, someone let me out of my cage. Now, time for me is nothing cause I'm counting no A's. Nah, I couldn't be there. Nah, you shouldn't be scared. I'm good at repairs and I'm under.
Hello, I'm Dr. John Bullock, sitting in for Mark Steiner, and you're listening to WEAA FM, celebrating the 88 Days of Summer. Details at WEAA.org. Again, we have Dr. Margaret Flowers, Carla Murphy, and Edward Wyckoff Williams with us today. And our last comment was really around some of the insensitive responses and insensitivity toward these tragedies. And one piece I thought was very interesting is even how it's portrayed by media outlets. The Associated Press, the AP, as many people know them, have a history of sometimes leading with the wrong foot, if you will. And this last tweet around the Renisha McBride case was very problematic. The quote, suburban Detroit homeowner convicted of second-degree murder for killing woman who showed up drunk on porch. Now, that caused a lot of backlash.
Was that the Associated Press?
Yes.
Wow.
And what's also interesting is it also harkens back to even if you look at Hurricane Katrina and you saw, you know, the two different pictures, right? One of an African-American who's carrying, they say he's looted a store versus a white couple who now has found or foraged for goods. So it looks like we do have Kadria back on. Let's go to Kadria, hear what you have to say. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, I am here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for calling.
I need to piggyback on your guest. All I can remember is his last name, which is the hyphenated name. I think the last was
Williams. Wyckoff Williams, yes.
Yes, sorry, sir. He started off saying that at the root of this American policies is really what he meant, the root American, Americanism, let me say, a new word maybe, okay, is something very sick and rotten. And it is. Because, you know, if we just remember, the laws of this land was never made to include us. If I'm not mistaken, I believe in the Dred Scott case decision, it said that if black man had no rights, that the white man was obligated to uphold. Okay.
Yeah.
It also said that it was against the law for any slave or a child of any slave to be a citizen of this country. If that has never been moved and replaced, then that gives some look into why we are treated like this, because we have no status. Not only the white people haters, everybody else coming from everybody else haters because of their exported image of us, okay? It also boils down to the fact that we cannot expect any justice from the Caucasians that rule this land. I'm sorry to say, not all of them, and I've got to say 96%, because it couldn't last for all these hundreds of years if all of them had a decent mind and a decent heart, okay? So we need to look elsewhere for justice. We're never going to get none here. And now they have a campaign to kill our black boys, because as we all know, those are the seeds of tomorrow. We have lasted too long. There's a man in the White House who is not white. The White House is made for white people, okay? They do not want that to happen again. And just to align this with the other world plans, they're doing the same thing in Palestine. The population there is mostly young men.
Look, you make some excellent points. We have limited time, but I thank you so much for calling in. You know, this kind of does.
Can I respond to that caller?
Yeah, and I know you as well.
I really appreciate. I appreciate what she said. It's very emotional, obviously, and it almost sounds like the pain and anguish of black mothers, and the fear that sending their boys or girls now into the streets might. They might receive phone calls that their child too is dead. This is a systemic problem, and I don't know. I don't even know if we're having the right conversation, because we need to be pushing some kind of solutions at a very high level, and I don't really know where we begin with that. But I'm glad that people are engaged in the debate.
If I could respond as well, I think that the point she brings up about, you know, who's kind of determining our public policy, and we also have some excellent studies this year that show that the public policies do not reflect the needs or interests of the majority of our population, that we really do live in an oligarchy or a plutocracy where the policy represents those who are the wealthiest. And if we look at the roots of this whole militarization and prison industrial complex, we see that there's, you know, when you have a military industrial complex that needs to continue producing and selling weapons, they have to continue to look for new markets. And now that market is our police force. And if you look at the private prison complex, which is signing contracts to guarantee 90% occupancy for 20 years, you see that drives, you know, the number of arrests and the number of people who are incarcerated. So,
and recidivism.
Right. And so we have to look at, you know, where is the real power? We're not going to see policies coming from our leaders, but we do have these studies. The ACLU has done some good studies on the militarization of police forces that we can use in our communities to start coming together and having these discussions and making demands on our police departments that they act in a more transparent and accountable manner and that they start to restrain themselves. And if we don't start doing that now, we're going to continue to see an escalation of these types of events.
You know, I think you used the correct word, escalation. Again, oftentimes we see a militarized police force, we see that it escalates the conflict rather than tamping it down.
Yeah.
Again, if you want to join the conversation, call us at 410-319-8888. Email your thoughts to talk@steinershow.org, tweet at Mark Steiner, or comment on the Mark Steiner Show on page on Facebook.
John?
Yes.
I want to get in here.
There's
a lot that was said, and I'm going to try to go through this really quickly, but I want to bring up something touching on perception just to make sure this is out there. The litany of names that you ran down, I want to be clear, these are names of people who either media or their communities or society, they recognize them as quote-unquote obviously innocent.
Mm-hmm.
So then we also have to think about, well, what happens to those who are not, who are perceived off the bat by their actions also as criminals. So we also have to look at those suspicious shootings towards people who we also identify straight off the bat as criminals. And
you know,
the list of names I'm suggesting then might be much longer.
No, you're making the appropriate point, because looking at your article, I think a lot of it, you know, it gets tied up when they say, well, this person has a history, or this person was engaged in some sort of activity,
right,
so therefore they're not a victim, when in fact some of these things are suspicious. And just because someone might have been engaged, something might have been in a certain place, doesn't mean that their life wasn't worth something and that they weren't killed.
Exactly. And then one of the things I think Edward brought up that was great. Number one, focusing on solutions. And two, well, where does the pain go and how do we react to the pain? So there are solutions to this, and people are working, and my reporting in Chicago suggests this, people are working in their communities. It's a matter of bringing these solutions to scale, recognizing them, and the political will to do so, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we always hear is people call for more cops, there's high crime, I want more cops. Okay, the cops solve some problems, but I think, and I've heard police officers say this themselves, they can't solve everything. So one of the approaches at a top level that people are calling for, too, is a public health approach to gun violence, for
mm-hmm.
example, as opposed to only the criminal justice system. So if you look at victimization, it is, and this is according to people who work with victims of violent crime all the time, the point after victimization is a turning point. It is the most vulnerable point in that young individual's life, and it's also the most vulnerable point in the family and friend's life. It's the time when you intervene, and if there are going to be retaliations, that is the time to stop them. We have a couple of programs focusing on that. So, for example, Ceasefire in Chicago is one of the largest and best known, but is that kind of approach, and that's a public health approach, is that being replicated, and is it being replicated to scale? And I just want to emphasize, there is, because I often hear this kind of despondence, as though there are no solutions, as though we can't control this problem. And actually, you can. It's a matter of recognizing that solutions do exist, and then also just bringing them to scale.
You know, it's funny, interesting you mentioned Ceasefire, because it really kind of brings it home to Baltimore. I mean, that's a program that's being adopted here. But again, the public health approach to it. And then oftentimes we do have people who can speak those issues in terms of dealing with on a community level, on interpersonal level, because we see the
violence. And I think that's a really sophisticated way of talking about it, because it sort of cuts through the debate and it introduces a conversation. I really appreciate that, actually.
Let's go to the phones. It looks like we have a couple callers waiting. George from Baltimore, you're on.
Yes, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
My problem is this. Why do we have to wait until a white person or a cop shoots a young black male or a young African-American female before we become galvanized to action? Where's the outrage when, you know, there are 200 or more murders in Baltimore, and most of them young black males. Where's the outrage then? Why is it that we have to be so reactionary when, you know, it happens, you know, from someone white? When there's black-on-black murder or just murder, period, why can't we be outraged when one single young man or woman is killed in Baltimore?
I think we lost you, but there's an interesting point. I mean, quite frankly, I've been seeing on social media and talked to a lot of people who said about community responsibility, that we can't just be outraged when, you know, whether it's a police officer or someone who's of a different race, but also even when it comes to things that happen in our community. Are we going to be good at policing our communities?
I am so tired. I am so sick and tired of the black on black crime meme, which has been created to further criminalize people who are over-criminalized. White people commit the vast majority of murders and violent crime in this country based on DOJ and FBI statistics, but there is no meme about white-on-white crime. I do not understand why black people have bought into the slave master's lie that they are somehow more criminal and more prone to violence. Stop it.
No, I mean, again, that's something that we really have to look at. If we start again, we talked earlier about, you know, the perceptions of criminality, right? And so the trope begins, hey, that, you know, that these young blacks, or blacks period, are tend to be overrepresented in criminal activity.
And what that does is set up a justification for the murder of young black males to say that, yes, even if this one was innocent, more than likely the others would have been guilty. It is sickening, and black people have got to stop repeating that lie themselves. Black crime needs to be something that we put to rest and bury.
You know, again, I think it came out even when we talked about previous talk about Trayvon Martin, and again, how the character winds up being assassinated and saying, well, this person, you know, had this infraction, this was an issue, as opposed to looking at the totality of what actually happened. We also got another tweet coming in from Susan that we could twice elect an African-American president while this continues, demonstrates that there is still much to overcome. And clearly we can see that. Also, Dottie online, too. We'd like to talk to you. You're on air.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to connect the comments by the first caller with the comment by one of the guests about where do we start to deal with this issue, because it's deeply related to many, many other things in our culture. First, as a white person, it's very, very painful to hear the comments of the first caller. And I think those kinds of perspectives continue in our country, because as a country, we have never acknowledged, faced, and paid for the original sin of enslavement and all the continuing exploitation and oppression of African descendant people in this country. And that until we do that as a country, I think we subtly affirm the kind of thinking that we heard from the first caller. I'm with an organization called Baltimore Racial Justice Action, and tomorrow evening we're doing a program on reparations called Reparations, It's Not Just About Slavery. And we would invite everyone to go to our website, Be More, with the letter B and the word more, antiracist.org. to see the details on that event.
You know, thank you, Dottie. I'm glad that you mentioned, you know, just getting back to, you know, the original sin of the country and thinking of, and it takes us back to the conversation we were having earlier about Jim Crowism. But I think we can look at statistics that tell us a lot. I mean, if you look at Missouri, right, 60 blacks are 66% more to be stopped by police. We see that blacks in 2013 were pulled over at 37% higher rates than whites. We also know that even before this, back in January, the local chapter of the NAACP filed a civil rights complaint against the St. Louis County Police, alleging that racism was rampant in the hiring and firing of discipline. And now they're asking the FBI to take over the investigation, and the FBI field office will be engaged in that. But again, we have a population similar to Baltimore that's about 70% black. And what's very interesting is that of the 53 officers in Ferguson, only three of them are black as well. So we can look at statistics that also tell us a lot about what's happening on the ground.
I think if I could add, yes, Dottie brings up a really important point, because there is a lot of kind of truth-telling that we need to go through as a nation and reconciliation. And in addition to the treatment of African-American people, we have a long history of continuing oppression and exploitation of our Native American population as well. And these are the kinds of stories that we really need to start telling and facing up to if we want to change and have a more just society.
You know, I wanted to add, you know, John, you brought up the police community relations and the racial profiling statistics in that part of Missouri. And one of the things that this shooting and the reaction to it, the protests, even the looting, it didn't happen in a vacuum, right? So when we start looking at the institutions and then how they serve Ferguson, one of the institutions that needs to be looked at as well is the media and the local media and how they cover the African-American communities there. And I would charge that, you know, the same way people are looking at the composition, for example, the racial composition of Ferguson's police force, Ferguson's fire department, they should also look at the racial composition of their local media. They are the ones in terms of creating perceptions of young African-American men. That's really who helps to create it. It's our local and national media.
Mm-hmm.
No,
that's really important.
Excellent. You know, one of the things that also we can talk about, too, is activism. And not just, you know, I think there are a couple times types of activism, right? There's that electronic activism, right, where it's talking about Twitter and Facebook and all that, cyber activism, if you will. And there's also the activists on the ground. And some would argue that really the outcome in the Renisha McBride case, in that actually justice to some degree was found, even though her life was lost, was attributable to the activists. It might not have been the media, but it might have been the activists, the cyber activists who were saying, keeping this issue alive, also those on the ground, but then also the fact that there was actually a black female prosecutor as well. Would you like to speak to some of those realities?
Yeah,
I think you hit the nail on the head. When we are represented in the prosecutorial process, I think it's so important. And in the jury process, one of the things about the demoralizing verdict in the Trayvon Martin case was literally you had five white women and a woman of African descent. Yeah, she was Puerto Rican, but and even in her after interviews, it was clear that she had been so influenced and intimidated in a weird way by the other jurors. I think that in order for us to have justice, we have to be a part of the process, and so that is often a missing piece. And I think it goes to what the other guest was just saying about we have to look at the composition of the police departments, the composition of the fire departments, and the composition of the media as well. That's also important when we're looking at juries and what prosecutors look like. Because when you live in this skin, then you have a shared experience that comes to bear when you are looking at facts.
You know, and what you just said really speaks to how messages are crafted, but then also how decisions are made. We have Mitchell, who's on the phone. We'd like to go to you. I know you've been waiting for a while. Mitchell, you're on the air.
Yes. One of the quotes of Martin Luther King said that he wasn't so much worried about the Ku Klux Klan or the overt racist people. He says part of the problem in America is the indifference of good white folks. Mm. And these issues ring up something when an innocent black person is murdered by the police. Where's the outrage of the good white American citizens? And I really believe if enough of them would be outraged, that a lot of this would stop. And when black folks say we get outraged when the police do something, why are we not outraged when black people kill black people? The issue is that this country is supposed to be founded on justice. The outrage comes from when somebody's innocent, not doing anything illegal, get murdered for their innocence, in their innocence. And it should always be outraged about that. And it should be outraged across the board, not just black folks. It should be outraged about with everybody who believe in justice. So let's deal with that and deal with this indifference of this larger community that has privilege. And if they were really serious about justice, they would support innocence and justice all around the board.
Thank you, Mitchell. What an excellent comment. And for those of you who may not have caught the reference, one of the things that he just referenced was even Dr. King's letter from Birmingham Jail, when he talks about the white moderate and talks about how they will say to King that about waiting and that, you know, the time may not be right. What do you have to say about the indifference as it relates to injustice? And we look at how and again, it goes back to the characterization of victims of color versus others. But also, I think there's also an opportunity here for allies that we have allies of different colors, of different regions, and I think it's important for us to speak to that reality, too.
I think that's I really, really appreciated Mitchell's point, and your follow-up is the reference to the Birmingham Jail letters from Dr. King. You know, there's a quote that says, the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes to the heart of the matter here, where indifference really is the problem, and I think it's the masses, i.e. white Americans, most of whom are good folks. You know, President Obama received a larger majority of the white vote than John Kerry did in 2004. I think that speaks to a progressive mindset among the majority of the people, whether they're white or black in this country. But I think when it comes to these kinds of issues, if you're not seeing your children killed unnecessarily and callously by police, then I think a lot of people do tend to be indifferent on the facts, particularly when they too have been influenced by our media to believe that young black males and black people in general are more criminal. And so I think that indifference is something that we need to be talking about. And I appreciate Mitchell bringing it up.
I agree that that's a very important point. And I think that the citizens' media, as I alluded to earlier, is a very powerful force. And we saw this in the Renisha McBride case, and we see it in other cases, that when we have this kind of the police putting out this message, the society putting out harmful messages, the media, we have the ability, if we act with intention and use our networks, we can change that message. We've seen it in other situations in this country. And I think that we need to do the same thing around this issue, that we are all connected. These are all of our children, and we should be working together to protect them.
I see we're getting low on time, but we have one more caller I want to get in. Brenda, before we get to some comments from our guests. So, Brenda, are you still there?
Yes, I am still here. This is real, a bunch of interesting comments, but the gentleman had called and talked about, he's really talking about inclusion into the processes of justice and all that. You know, I am well in my 60s now. Lived in New York through the 60s, and remember everything that happened, okay? This whole situation to me seems like a case of a battered wife. He beats the hell out of her. She goes back again. He's sorry. She goes back again, and he beats her. The lady said solutions to go into it. I can't see us incorporating ourselves into a system that was never made with us in mind, okay?
Yeah. Thank you. Again, it's always good to have that feedback from our callers. I think you make some excellent points. You know, I want to think about what do we do next as we're getting low on time moving forward. Oftentimes, you know, these conversations we talk about, you know, live issues. But what do we do from this point on? What are our steps? We could start with you.
I think we have a great opportunity coming up. This Baltimore Racial Justice Action, you know, dialogue is a place to go and discuss these issues. I think it really does come down to organizing in our communities to look at how our police are behaving, look at our criminal justice policies, and decide as communities whether these are acceptable to us or not. And if not, then we should be organizing to change them.
All right. Final words, Carla Murphy?
Yeah, sure. Listen, I think that after incidents like this, there's always a lot of noise, a lot of chatter. But one of the things that was helpful for me this morning, I read Tremaine Lee's, this is MSNBC reporter, he talked to the young man who was with Michael Brown at the time he was shot and killed. And it is a riveting account. And the image that stays with me, and I think this is the thing for everyone to focus on, is the loss of this 18-year-old man's life. The image that stays with me is of him being shot in the back, turning around with his hands up, and according to the eyewitness here, the police officer continuing to shoot. That is at the center of this case, and that is the main point of it. And then lastly, I want to emphasize that there are solutions to all of this. People are working on solutions to all of this. And I would encourage, and sorry for the plug, everyone, But go to colorlines.com, and there are definitely organizations listed there. There are also national organizations, and it can definitely, you know, this feeling of impotence or that it can't be solved. Sometimes I think that that kind of apathy or that despondence is quite dangerous.
Edward, last words?
I really appreciate everything that both Carla and Margaret have said. It's been a pleasure to be on with you guys, and you have done an amazing job, John. But let me just say, one of the things that strikes me, that Carla just said, talking about empathy, and then going back to this idea of indifference. After the shootings at the school in Connecticut, in Newtown, Connecticut, where literally babies were just their bodies were destroyed by an assault rifle in the hands of a young white male, there seemed to be this momentum in the country to get gun control. And it failed. And I think a lot of black people in particular were kind of shocked that white children were murdered and white policymakers in Washington did nothing. And the NRA actually has that much power and influence. I think when we begin to talk about next steps, we have to realize how deeply entrenched the problem goes in this country. We don't just have a militarization of the police. We have a proliferation of guns. And we have such deeply entrenched poverty and racism that the problem is vast. And that requires the people who are listening to us to get organized, to get involved in their communities the way Margaret was talking about and Carla were talking about. We need a revolution, and we might need riots. There must be outrage in order to respond to such a vast problem.
I couldn't say it any better. Any last thoughts, Mark?
Just, you know, there's a lot of information about how to organize and about these issues on popularresistance.org, so I recommend that people go to that website, and I agree with Carla and Edward. I think that we definitely need a transformation of our society, and we do that by educating ourselves and organizing and mobilizing and looking at what works most strategically, so... I agree.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much to our guest, Dr. Margaret Flowers, organizer of PopularResistance.org, co-host of the Clearing the Fog radio program, Carla Murphy, reporter and blogger for ColorLines.com, and Edward Wyckoff-Williams, contributing editor at The Root. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Now, on our way to break, we're going to be hearing Sukiyaji by Kiyo Sakamoto. On this day in 1985, Sakamoto was killed in a plane crash. He was the first Japanese artist to have a number one single in the U.S. ないように思い出す春の日ひとりぼっちの夜上を向いて歩こうよにじんだ星を